We are dealing with the actions and beliefs of white supremacists in the America of today. It is far from the first time. After the Civil War, the first iteration of the Ku Klux Klan rose up in the South to challenge federal authority and rights newly granted to freed slaves. In today's world, the FBI would take a major role in working against the Klan. Back then, there was no FBI, so it fell upon the U.S. Secret Service to do the work. And the leader of the Secret Service, then, is the focus of a new book by Charles Lane called Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Man Who Masterminded America's First War on Terror. Charles Lane is an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post, a member of the editorial board there. He also covered the Supreme Court for the Post, served as editor of The New Republic, and has written two previous books. Charles Lane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jeff.
So how did you make the decision to write this book?
Well, like many people these days, reflecting on the similarities maybe between the two eras, I'm fascinated by Reconstruction, that period after the Civil War when so much was up for grabs in American life and American politics. And in writing one of those previous books that you mentioned, kind of ran across this interesting character, Hiram C. Whitley, who had such a fascinating role in that period but had been kind of forgotten. And I made a mental note. I said to myself, this is the most interesting American I've never heard of before. And I made a mental note to come back to his story, and I did, and the result is this book.
Were you able to lay your hands on many original source documents in the process of researching the book?
That was one of the most fascinating and intriguing and enjoyable parts of doing this book, was finding the hunt for these original documents, which included the original agent reports and other records of the Secret Service, which are at the U.S. National Archives, but also Hiram Whitley's personal scrapbooks, which are found in a historical society in Kansas. I even made contact eventually with some of his descendants who had preserved personal photographs and personal family records and documents. So there was quite a bit of material, although I must say that probably one of the reasons that this story wasn't told earlier is that because the documents were hard to find, it was just a hard story to investigate.
Well, kudos to you for digging as deeply as you did to find as much as you found about Hiram Whitley, which is considerable. Before we get to Hiram, let's set the stage a bit. We're talking about the years after the Civil War, the Reconstruction years, 40 years before the Bureau of Investigation even came into existence. How limited were federal law enforcement capabilities?
Basically, the federal government had no general criminal investigative force until the Civil War ended. And in the very last days of the Civil War, the federal government formed in the Treasury Department something called the Secret Service, the goal of which, or the main mission of which, was to investigate counterfeiting. By the way, that's a mission that agency still has today, even though most of its work involves protecting the president and other dignitaries. And for a few years, it did focus exclusively on counterfeiting and some other frauds like smuggling through the ports and things like that. But as the Klan emerged in the South and the government was kind of scrambling around for any resources and expertise it could find, they hit upon the idea of using these detectives as to infiltrate the Klan.
You know, I hesitate to ask the question because the answer should be obvious, but why didn't state authorities do anything about the Klan?
Well, interestingly, some states tried. And in fact, it's an important thing to remember that at an early stage of Reconstruction, through the intervention of Congress, states were kind of required to, in the South, were required to allow African Americans to vote. And the result was that governments of the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party in that time, were at least briefly in control of states like Alabama, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And those governments, both out of a sense of principle and in their own self-interest, did try to pursue the Klan. They even fielded briefly their own detectives. The problem was that those resources and their legal powers were just too limited, and the Klan just too overwhelmingly powerful within their states to sort of handle the job on their own.
So was the Klan's creation basically a reaction to Reconstruction to undo the work that Republicans were doing both in Washington and in the states across the South?
Absolutely. And you can almost date the emergence of the Klan as a terrorist organization to the first federal civil rights legislation, which was enacted over President Andrew Johnson's veto in 1866. You know, prior to that, the Klan barely existed, and it was just a few local outfits of people who, it was kind of like a social club, who dressed up in funny costumes and did parades. But very quickly after the Civil Rights Act passed, those groups kind of changed character and formed the infrastructure of what came to be essentially the armed clandestine terrorist wing of the Southern Democratic Political Party, basically the ex-Confederate army, kind of at night, so to speak, and was very widespread by 1867 or 68, very widespread in the Southeast.
So you take us to Columbus, Georgia in March of 1868. Who was George W. Ashburn?
George W. Ashburn was a leading Republican pro-civil rights politician and the first victim of a Klan assassination, I believe, in American history, a Klan political assassination. And at night on March 31st of 1868, at midnight, a group of men in masks broke into his house and murdered him. And that set the stage for Hiram C. Whitley's first major case, somewhat before he headed the Secret Service, but as a detective working for the Army. He was brought into Columbus, Georgia to work up that case and get to the bottom of it.
We'll find out more about the murder of George W. Ashburn and how Freedom's detective Hiram C. Whitley was able to track it down as we talk more with Charles Lane, the author of the book Freedom's Detective. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Charles and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Charles Lane, who is an op-ed columnist and editorial board member of The Washington Post, is with us here on the program today talking about his latest book called Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, the Ku Klux Klan, and the man who masterminded America's first war on terror. That would be Hiram C. Whitley, who ended up being the second boss of the U.S. Secret Service. We were talking about how he got involved in busting up the Klan in the South in the days after the Civil War. You can join us on the exchange with your thoughts, comments, questions, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just broached the subject of George Ashburn, possibly the first Klan assassination in the United States on March 31st, 1868. A prominent Republican who stood for civil rights in the South after the Civil War. Not a popular way of looking at things, apparently. There was an editorial you quote here in the Columbus Sun saying that Ashburn hoped to riot in the ruin of his kind. That's kind of a fancy way of calling a race traitor, isn't it?
Absolutely. And he was a hated man in Columbus, Georgia by, unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of whites. His death was a tremendous shock to the entire country. One of the things that really struck me in doing the research was that, you know, the death of one politician in a seemingly obscure corner of the South suddenly made headlines all over the United States as people in the North realized that the rumors and stories they were hearing about this strange new organization of the Klan in the South might actually be true and might actually be causing bloodshed. And as we were discussing, that was a big part of the impetus behind the investigation. The U.S. government in Washington, dominated at that point by a Republican Congress and by a U.S. Army led by Ulysses Grant and the other winners, the victors in the Union cause, felt it was vital to get to the bottom of this because and punish the perpetrators because they didn't want this to spread. And so it was a very pivotal moment at that stage of Reconstruction.
Well, even then, with the structure of government in post-war South, with military districts and all that sort of thing, there were local police. What efforts did they make in investigating Ashburn's murder?
Well, getting ahead of the story a little bit, but Whitley and the others who were helping him quickly found out that the police themselves of Columbus, Georgia, had been involved in the murder. And in fact, it was even more alarming that they learned that one member of the U.S. Army detachment in Columbus had been involved. So there was a tremendous challenge here in that no local cooperation could be expected from the white community on the one hand, and on the other hand, the African-American community, many of whom did have some information, were subject to tremendous intimidation from the Klan. So Whitley had to really innovate and had to come up with smart tactics that enabled him ultimately to get the testimony from people inside the Klan or witnesses who were otherwise reluctant to come forward.
So let's start dipping our toes into the Hiram C. Whitley pool here. He was already known by this point for his investigative skills. That's why he was hired. How did he obtain those skills?
Well, not honestly altogether, I have to admit. And this is another fascinating aspect of the story. In the 19th century, both in Europe and in the United States, detectives were not that much of a, they were not that respected or respectable because they often had been criminals or at the margin of the law themselves in the past. And that was true of Whitley. Before the Civil War, he was arrested for kidnapping in Kansas because he actually tried to waylay a group of abolitionists and escaping slaves on the Kansas frontier. He had a very sketchy background, and nevertheless, those skills of deception, fraud, selective violence, and so on, they are the tools of the trade in espionage and infiltration and secret agency, as we all know. And so over the course of the Civil War, he became a spy for the Union in the Deep South, in Union-occupied areas of the Deep South. And his skills were put to the use of the federal government. It was an interesting transition that would be hard to imagine today, but was actually rather common in the 19th century.
The transition from what to what?
From being a criminal to being a cop, and from being somebody who was involved in deception and infiltration on one side of the Civil War to, in effect, the other. And that was another thing. You asked me earlier why I was so interested in Hiram C. Whitley. I was intrigued by the character of someone who had, in effect, been on one side of the great national conflict and then went to the other side. And I wanted to know how somebody could pull that off and what it would do to him and what it meant for the government.
Well, and that's the question that arose in my mind, is whether Hiram C. Whitley was just good at passing or if he had, in fact, malleable sympathies.
I think it's some of both. And I think part of what makes this project for me very interesting, and I hope for readers, is that it challenges you to think about the whole question of moral consistency. Is there any consistency between somebody like this who, before the Civil War, takes actions that are oppressive toward African Americans, and then after the Civil War takes actions that have the effect of promoting their rights and helping to liberate them? And how do we make that balance in the lifetime of a single person? Because in a way, that's symbolic of the trajectory of the whole country, isn't it? That the whole country has moved from one approach to another, and yet we were the same people, so to speak, all along. And that's what I find so fascinating about Whitley, is that he was the same person all the way through, but he fought on two different sides in the course of that period.
It bears to memory the story of John Marshall Harlan on the Supreme Court, who was avowedly pro-slavery, did not think that the slaves should be freed after the Civil War, and yet when he was on the court, the Supreme Court, for the Plessy versus Ferguson case, he was the one person who voted against separate but equal as a doctrine.
Yes, and there were many Americans like that. Many people learned and changed through the course of their lives, and one of the things that you have to, as a reader of my book, you have to kind of judge for yourself is, Was Whitley one of those who learned and changed like Harlan, or was he just the whole time kind of an opportunist? And does it make a difference if the results are good? Does it make a difference if the person acted out of pure motives or maybe not so pure motives? That's why I said before, you know, this guy, Whitley, is one of the most interesting Americans you've never heard of, or at least until my book, when I hope when I hope a lot of people will hear of him.
We know more now, that is for sure. I can only imagine, as I think about background checks for government work today, that Hiram Whitney might have some trouble with that.
He would not pass today's government background checks. And in fact, it's a great question, because You have put your finger on something that was so different in the 19th century, that people, it was hard to get information about people's history. And sometimes, even if you had that information, and I think the Grant administration, when they hired Whitley, they pretty much knew both the good and the bad of his record. But there wasn't very much transparency about it. The government was not really obliged to lay bare Hiram C. Whitley's record before they put him on in charge of the Secret Service. There was no congressional confirmation process. There was no public hearing. And in fact, his promotion to the Secret Service was announced publicly in basically one line or two of the newspapers. And it wasn't until about a year or so into the job that he kind of went public.
In fact, that Whitley found out about his hiring from the newspaper, didn't he?
Yes, he was on another job, another mission, at breaking up illegal liquor production in Virginia when he actually read in the newspaper that he had been appointed. And so he got on the next train, went back to Washington, and accepted the position.
Hiram C. Whitley is our focus here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Charles Lane from the Washington Post about Hiram. He wrote a book about Hiram called Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Man Who Masterminded America's First War on Terror. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Whitley got to Columbus about a month after the murder of George Ashburn, a Republican leader who was reviled in the white community for supporting civil rights for the newly freed slaves. Whitley, well, he proposed some things to enhance his interrogation efforts. What kinds of things did he do?
Well, they were stymied in the investigation because no witnesses would talk and the suspects were out on bail. And Whitley said, look, we have to get everyone out of Columbus, because Columbus is dominated by the Klan. We have to take them somewhere where I, Hiram C. Whitley, will be dominant. And the place they selected was an island fort off the coast of Savannah, Georgia. They put everybody on a train and sent them out there. And basically, Whitley had them at his mercy and interrogated. In a couple of cases, he did things that we would consider torture today. But kind of browbeat everyone and isolated everyone, and in the case of intimidated witnesses, could give security in those conditions so they would feel protected, and after a few weeks was able to get at the truth. And of course, the parallel with today, and you use the term enhanced interrogation, is really interesting, and it's one reason I refer to this as the first war on terror. Because that's one instance you can think of, like taking everyone to an island. What does that remind you of? I wouldn't say it was exactly like Guantanamo, but it was so interesting that the government, in fighting a terrorist organization, felt that it had to create a place where there was no, there were no recourse for the people it was interrogating. They couldn't get access to lawyers and so on. And it was controversial at the time, at the in the pro-Klan press, and at the trial, Whitley was accused of torture way beyond what he had actually done. He was accused of threatening and bullying and bribing, and so there was a real civil liberties debate over this as well.
So how was the trial set up, and wow, who were these lawyers?
Well, it was an incredible scene, the trial of the alleged Ashburn murderers, because some of the murderers were extremely prominent and wealthy people in Columbus. And so they were able to recruit some of the most prominent and wealthy attorneys in Georgia, including the former vice president of the Confederacy. And on the other side, you had military lawyers, because it was a military commission. Again, an eerie parallel with our current issues. And this was a time when there had not yet been reestablished a civilian state government in Georgia. The U.S. military was administering the situation, and these people were brought before a Union Army military commission to stand trial.
Wow, I hope nobody held their breath for a conviction. What actually happened?
Well, the case was overwhelmingly proven against these men, because Whitley had so effectively flipped some of the conspirators to testify against the higher-ups. But the Columbus prisoners, as they were known, became a cause of the white supremacist Democrats in Georgia at the time, and they actually agreed to ratify the 14th Amendment and restore state sovereignty to Georgia as a way to get the military's authority lifted. And so before the military commission could render its verdict, the state's own criminal law authority was restored and the military commission was disbanded. So it was kind of an anticlimax and frustrating for Whitley, although he believed that the most important thing, which was the exposure of the truth, had been accomplished.
But everybody walked then, right?
They did. And in fact, one of the bitter ironies to me of this story is that one of the men who was a principal leader of the Klan in Columbus, Georgia, a man called William D. Chipley, went on to have a very prosperous life as a railroad entrepreneur in the South, and there's even a town in Florida named after him.
Oh, boy. We are talking about the post-war days, post-Civil War days, with Charles Lane about his book about Hiram C. Whitley, who was the head of the Secret Service in the days of early Reconstruction. The book is called Freedom's Detective. Here's a call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. After the war, the Republicans were considered basically the great defenders of the Negro race. And nowadays, they seem to be the folks that are most interested in suppressing their voters' rights and suppressing them in general. Do you have any ideas as to how and why this came about?
Okay, thanks for the question. Appreciate it, Steve.
Well, it's a long historical process, but I think the basic picture is that in our country, Republican and Democrat are really just labels, as we've learned over a couple hundred years worth of history, and that our parties are changeable coalitions of different interest groups in society. And as a result of the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1960s, basically Republicans and Democrats in the South kind of changed places. I mean, I would never accuse today's Republican Party of being exactly like the Southern Democrats of the 1860s. I'm not saying that, but it is nevertheless true that they are thought of today as much more reluctant to expand civil rights protections than today's Democrats. And I would add that there is a faint echo of the issues of Reconstruction in the controversies over alleged voter suppression in many states. And of course, not all southern states in this country. So there's that issue as well.
Right. And when I lived in Alabama in the early 80s, all the statewide officials were still Democrats. And then once the Gingrich Revolution and the takeover of the House in 1994, everybody switched to Republicans within a few years, it seemed like.
Yes. I mean, probably the most salient case of this goes back a little earlier. Strom Thurmond, who was the senator and governor from South Carolina, and even ran as a states' rights Dixiecrat for president in 1948, an absolute segregationist for most of his career, was a Democrat until the mid-1960s when he switched to being a Republican. And that was a real harbinger of what was to come.
So did Hiram Whitley think he had made a major dent in the Klan when he came back to Washington from the South?
I think he believed that in the Ashburn case, the results were more positive than negative. And nevertheless, in the immediate aftermath of that, his attention went elsewhere, mainly to fighting counterfeiting, as we were discussing. By 1871, when he was well underway at the Secret Service, it became clear that the Klan had not actually been beaten back, either by what Whitley had done in Georgia or by what other, as we were discussing before, state governments had tried to do in the Carolinas. And so it was at that point in early 1871 when the federal government, Congress, and then President Grant adopted tougher measures that allowed the Army and the Secret Service to operate.
We will get into that more in the next segment. We're talking with Charles Lane about his book, Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, the Ku Klux Klan, and the man who masterminded America's first war on terror. That man will be Hiram C. Whitley, the second head of the Secret Service, which was on the scene to do the work of federal law enforcement long before there was a Bureau of Investigation. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. Talk more about Hiram C. Whitley, and we welcome your phone calls and emails as well when we rejoin our conversation with Charles Lane in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We have the pleasure today of talking to Charles Lane, op-ed columnist and editorial board member of The Washington Post, covered the Supreme Court for The Post, was editor of The New Republic for a time, has written two previous books. The one we're talking about now is his latest book about Hiram C. Whitley, who headed the Secret Service in the days after the Civil War, at a time when the Secret Service was really the only federal police agency capable of taking on the Ku Klux Klan. The book is called Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, the Ku Klux Klan, and the man who masterminded America's first war on terror. Questions, comments, things you want to know more about this time, join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Charles, we've already established that the major function of the Secret Service in those days was to work against counterfeiting, which really kind of requires us to back up a little bit and talk about paper money in America. It did not have a long history by this time.
Really, before the Civil War, the only widespread paper currencies were issued by the states, and they were widely forged and counterfeited. During the Civil War, the national government, for the first time, developed a national currency, and people tried to counterfeit that. And so in 1865, they formalized this detective service called the Secret Service to try to get at these counterfeiting gangs, which were pretty sophisticated in many cases, and basically were kind of organized crime gangs. They weren't very violent, but they were very sophisticated and very secretive.
Was undercover work known then, or did the Secret Service under Hiram Whitley kind of create it or write the book on it?
Undercover work existed, but mostly in Europe. In fact, it was kind of a French and German innovation, this idea of a standing police force that kind of had its agents secretly at work among the civilian population. And for that very reason, the introduction of the Secret Service, even to fight counterfeiting, was very controversial in the United States. A great many people thought this was inconsistent with the small r Republican institutions of a country like the United States. They felt that the federal marshal should have been allowed to deal with this. And Whitley, in his public statements and newspaper articles and books and things like that, argued very vociferously from the other side, which was that, look, we have a serious problem here, and this is the only way to deal with it. You can't be so naive. And by the way, today it's taken for granted that it's okay for the government to operate undercover as long as it's, you know, with warrants and constrained by the law and so on. But it was really startling to learn how how foreign to many Americans that idea seemed at the time.
And you mentioned public statements by Whitley in defense of the practices. There was one case in particular, the Minor case that you talk about in the book, that brought him a lot of scrutiny. How did he look under that harsher light?
Well, Whitley had to testify at the counterfeiting trial of the biggest counterfeiter in New York. This was a huge triumph for Whitley and the Secret Service to bring Joshua D. Minor into court. And Whitley was put on the stand. And they started, the defense lawyers started to review all of his not-so-clean record from before the Civil War. And this resulted in an acquittal for Minor, even though he was clearly guilty. And Whitley's agents had caught him in the act of passing counterfeit plates to a printer. But the jury held that because the Secret Service detectives themselves weren't honest men, their word couldn't necessarily be trusted. And so Whitley was enraged by this, and he fought back by writing long essays, an open letter to the American people defending the work of detectives and the necessity of the work of detectives. And again, this was extraordinary. This was completely new in American history. No unelected bureaucrat from inside the executive branch had ever, you know, directly addressed the American people on his own behalf in that way. And Whitley was bold like that.
You mentioned about 1871, he ended up back in the South facing the Klan again. What were the circumstances?
Well, basically, as we were discussing before, the Klan had staged a comeback, and it had the Republicans and their African-American supporters kind of intimidated and on the run. Whitley sent his agents into the South in disguise to a number of jurisdictions, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, also Mississippi, with instructions that he had sort of laid out for them in detail from his headquarters in New York. And the basic mission was to convince these Klansmen around the South that these Secret Service agents sympathized with them, obviously not revealing they were Secret Service agents. And they would open small businesses in these local communities or enter as itinerant peddlers of bootleg alcohol, things like that. And eventually they won the confidence of these people and were let in on all their meetings and all their secrets, you know, until, of course, they provided the information to the federal prosecutors and to the executive branch back in Washington.
Why did it have to be federal prosecutors? I mean, the federal government pretty much had to do the work with this. Was the state government so deeply in? I mean, were the people in state government so deeply in the Klan themselves that they wouldn't enforce the law, basically?
No jury in North Carolina would have been free of Klan intimidation during this time. If it were a state jury, it would have consisted of, you know, white people, most of them white men, most of whom can sympathize with the Klan. Federal juries under federal law were required to take an oath that they were not sympathetic with the Klan. And so the federal system was the only place where you could guarantee that an uncontaminated jury, so to speak, would convict one of these suspects. And so it all had to be done in the federal system under federal authority, all of this under new statutory law that was created in 1871. It was quite a systemic response that attempted to avoid restarting the Civil War and military operations and to use the instruments of criminal law to stop this conspiracy.
There's a passage in the book where you lay this clearer than perhaps anybody else whose work I've ever written, read rather, but the idea that the enraged feelings in the South after the Civil War among the white population had to find some channel because they couldn't go to war. They'd done that already and had failed.
Yes, there were few options to the white supremacists of the South who were interested in restoring their old dominance over these state governments. They couldn't, in their minds, one thing they ruled out, of course, was any kind of equal cooperation with African Americans. And the Klan was a subversive organization. It was all done at night, in secret, deniable. It was, in that sense, a true terrorist organization because it was an organization that had political objectives. one of the most important things to understand about the Klan was that it was organized as a means of, in effect, winning elections through violence and intimidation. All the election years of that period, 1868, 70, and 72, were focal points of Klan activity. And of course, that's one reason it was so important for Whitley, the Secret Service, and the Army, and the others to focus on that period, 1871-72, to ensure the security of that election.
We have talked already about some Southern Republican politicians who stood up to the Klan. George Ashburn paid a big price for that. He died. Amos Akerman, though, we haven't talked about yet. What was the approach he advocated for dealing with the Klan?
He was the Attorney General at the beginning of the Grant administration. In fact, the first Attorney General to head the Justice Department, which was formed in 1870, and he was from Georgia. Though he had migrated there from New Hampshire many years earlier, he thought of himself as a Southerner and a Republican, and he had briefly served in the Confederate Army, but believed after the Civil War that the time had come to change and that the best thing forward for the South was to recognize the rights of African Americans and to live together. He was a remarkable person, and he was bitterly opposed to the Klan. And he was the person who kind of orchestrated the legal side of the anti-Klan effort and recruited Whitley to lead it from the investigative side. He was aware, because he was from Georgia, of the success Whitley had had in breaking the Ashburn case, and he thought it could be applied, that Whitley's skill could be applied to this later period as well.
Was there a single major sensational break for Whitley and the Secret Service, or was it just sort of a long slog of this case, that case?
Probably their biggest, most spectacular success took place in North Carolina, where one of Whitley's best agent, Joseph Hester, managed to capture eight Klansmen in the act as they attempted to hang a white Republican. In fact, Hester himself was on the scene in a Klansman's robe until he revealed who he really was and arrested all these people with the help of U.S. troops who he had alerted ahead of time. And then after these arrests, paraded these captured Klansmen and their uniforms through the streets of Raleigh, North Carolina, as African Americans applauded. That was probably one of the most spectacular defeats the Klan suffered in this entire period.
In hindsight, though, Charles, was the Klan's demise the first time around? It sort of disappeared for a few decades. Was it because of things like what Whitley was doing, or was it more perhaps about the deconstruction of Reconstruction and the passing of Jim Crow laws, which confirmed the triumph of white supremacy across the South?
It's true that this defeat of the Klan, or forced retreat, might be a better term, was short-lived. And though the Klan as such disappeared mostly after 1872, new white paramilitary organizations arose and had a bad influence on Southern politics thereafter. You know, the way I would look at it is, of course, the Klan kind of never goes away because the spirit of that animates the Klan, unfortunately, never quite goes away. So there was a huge national resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, motivated mainly by hostility toward immigrants. But the Klan came back in the 50s and 60s when the Civil Rights Movement took place. It's a very pale shadow of its former self, but yes, there were Klansmen at Charlottesville in 2017. So this is part of the reason I think my book is relevant is that it's the history of something that's still with us today in much smaller and weaker form, but unfortunately is a long-term aspect of our political culture.
Yeah, I caught myself a couple times chuckling about the outcomes of some of the skirmishes that took place against the Klan back then, but then have to remember that, yes, this is something that we still deal with. Is there another book in you about the KKK in the 20th century, if you had enough with covering this?
No, I hadn't thought of doing that. I think some other people have done it already pretty well. But I am still interested, very fascinated in the Reconstruction period, and I think there's still maybe other topics to be dealt with related to that time.
I am fascinated by how the outcome of the basically tied 1876 presidential election, how huge a role that played in the ending of Reconstruction.
Sounds like a good idea for a book.
One of us will have to get to it first. What do you think Hiram C. Whitley's legacy is? I mean, he certainly is a person who had people feeling mixed ways about him in his lifetime. I just wonder what you ended up with at the end of all this research.
I can't help but be a little ambivalent about him. I tend to think that there was a debate in his time, was Hiram C. Whitley a scoundrel or a great public servant? And my answer is yes. He was a scoundrel who was a great public servant in certain moments. And the regrettable thing about Whitley is that in the end, he couldn't really control the dark side of himself. He didn't know when to say no when people asked him to do things that were not legal, and that was the cause of his downfall. If he had been able to resist that, he probably would have remained chief of the Secret Service much longer, past 1874. And all the good things he was capable of, the modernization, the innovation, the skill that he brought to the job might have come to the fore, and the Secret Service itself might have developed into a true federal investigative bureau like we finally got in the 20th century might have developed in that direction earlier. But as it is, we have to just evaluate him on what he actually did and what actually happened.
And there's quite a list of the things he did in the book. It's called Freedom's Detective, The Secret Service, The Ku Klux Klan, and The Man Who Masterminded America's First War on Terror. That was Hiram C. Whitley. The author is Charles Lane. Charles, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.